afternoon. So, Skadron mentioned last time, I'm substituting for him today. And I believe when we finished off last time, you did this example. Let's do another one. Start out. Okay, so we have our contents of physical memory. We know where our page table base register is, which means that we have a first level page table located starting here. We're told that page tables are one page, which means 8 bytes. So that means this first level page table is these 8 bytes. And we want to translate this virtual address. You should try to work a little bit ahead of me. All right. I'll start explaining things. Give you a little bit of time to work through this. And we'll go over what should be the answer. So I'll go through my first steps here. And first, I have this virtual address, and I know my addresses in general are a page number and a page offset. And it will be useful to split this address up into those two pieces, because we know the way our translation works is we do most of the work with a page number, and then at the very end, we tack on the page offset. And our virtual or physical addresses, we split them up the same way. It's just that we have a different virtual page number versus the final physical page number. And I'm told we have 8-byte pages. That's 2 to the 3 bytes. So I need 3 bits to say which of those 2 to the 3 bytes, because I have 8 bytes. I need numbers 0 through 7 to identify them. That's 3 bits. So my page offset is 3 bits. And the rest of my address, well, I'm told there's 9-bit virtual addresses. So that tells me that in my virtual addresses, I have 6 bits here. Another way we could have found that out is that I know my page tables are 8 bytes. My page table entries are 1 byte. So 8 bytes equals 8 entries in this case, or 2 to the 3rd entries. And we know the parts of our virtual page table number, virtual page number, are the indices into the page table. So those parts must range from 0 to 7, the 8 possible values. So I can say that the two parts here must each be 3 bits, and that would be another way I could find out the addresses are 9 bits. But either way, I find out we have a 6-bit page number that's split into 2 3-bit parts for the 2 levels we have in this example, and then a page offset. And if I look at my initial virtual address here, 0FB, I've just written this out as binary. And I need to remember that just because I used 3 hexadecimal radix to write out the number doesn't mean it's 12 bits. Because, well, I had a 9-bit number. I had to write it out using, either 2 hexadecimal digits or 3, basically, and none of those are going to multiply by 4 to 9. So the part that actually matters are these 9 bits here. And I can split that up further, and I can say 0, 1, 1. This is the virtual page number part 1. Then our 1, 1, 1 is our virtual page number part 2. And our 0, 1, 1 is our page offset. And if we remember what our page table lookup as sort of a series of array lookups, we can say, okay, we're going to take our PTBR. That's going to get us an array. This is going to be the index into that array. That's going to get us another array. This second page table, virtual page number part, is going to be the index into that array. And then that's going to get us yet another array, which is our final physical page. And this is the index into that. Right, we're going to do a bunch of array lookups using that information. So questions on my figuring sort of at a high level here? Numbers, yeah. When do I add the page offset? So that's my final array lookup, so not until the very end. Okay. Other questions? Okay, and I have pre-worked out on this slide, hopefully a correct answer to this. So we split it up into our parts, and I'm going to use the first part. So this is 3, 7, 3, right? Those are our parts. My first part, I'm going to say I take my base register plus the page table entry size, which happens to be 1 in this example, but won't be in a real system, times 3, and that gets me the address 0xb, which is here. And another way we could think about that is that I wanted to get to index 3 of this array of 1-byte things. Here is, at the beginning of the array, is index 0. That's one byte. Then we have index 1, 2, 3. So that gets me that address and the value there, and that's what I actually care about, that's OXBB. And I'm going to decode that based on this page table entry format. And I'm going to find out that it refers to physical page number 5, and it's valid. If it wasn't valid, we'd stop and say, it's invalid, the OS has to do something about this. There's no translation. But it is valid. So we're going to use virtual page number 5 as the place of our second table, our second array lookup. Now, physical page number 5. Physical page number 5 isn't a full address, right? I don't have labels for physical pages on this diagram. I have labels for bytes. That's how my addresses work. So I need to convert that to a byte number. And the way I can do that is I can say, 5 times 8, that's going to be my byte number. Why 8? Because that's my page size. And that is also known as OX28. So this is where page 5 is, equals 5 times 8 here. Or alternately, 5 shifted left by 3. Yes?
How did it go from 0xfb to
0xf3?
Was that some conversion or
is
that a typo?
That is a typo. Sorry. Because we have a 1 here, it's clearly not 3. Thank you for finding that. I'll just write this more clearly. So, not. Yes. Yeah.
Where did the 101, I guess I must have, how you got the 101 and the 5 in the next step?
The question is, where did this 101 come from? So we got this value, right?
Yes.
That's our page table entry. And that I need to decode into the fields of the page table entry. My instructions for doing that are here, that I'm told the processor we're imagining here formats its page table entries as one byte integers where the top bits are the physical page number, then a valid bit, then something else.
Okay.
And I just follow that format, and you have to look for that because different processors are going to use a different format.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
I'm just a little bit confused on how you're indexing. Once you get to the fifth page, that blue selected section of memory, how do you get to the byte that contains F0?
Yeah, so the question is why, once I figured out this is our page 5, physical page 5, why did I select F0? So this is my array, and my index into the array is 7. And I know my array elements are one byte, so 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, or more simply, I added 7, the index times the array element size, 1, to the initial address, and that gives us OX2F. Other questions? Yes?
Why did you multiply the 5 by an 8? How did you get to 0x28 as your register?
So the question is, why did I multiply 5 by 8? Because 5 is a page number. So my first page number 0 is here. So where does the second page start? It starts at byte 8. And that's because pages are 8 bytes. So, another way of thinking about it is I'm doing another array lookup, but the array elements are pages. Does that answer your question? Okay. Another question? Yeah. Can I do what? Can I do what alphabet level? The 5 to. So your question is like, so I wanted to get from 5 to 0x to 8, right? From BB to 5, oh, 5, sure. Can I write that out? Sure. Let me be here. So 0x BB is going to be 1011, 1011. Assuming I remember things correctly. And our format was that a page table entry consisted of a 3-bit physical page number, a 1-bit valid bit, and 4 other bits. So I'm just going to match that up to this number. And that's how it matches up, and 101 is 5. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so that got us to our second level page table entry. So we found this F0 in here. I encoded that using the same procedure and found out it had physical page number 111 or 7 and a valid bit of 1. That says our final array lookup, the actual physical page that this last level refers to, is this page 7, starts at 0x38 or 7 times 8. And I wanted offset 3 in there, 0, 1, 2, 3. That's this 0C. And that's what will actually be accessed. So if this was a read, we'd read that value. If it's a write, we'd replace that value. Okay, so questions on our page table lookup? Yes?
Can you go over one more time how you would have known it was a 9-bit virtual address had it not specified that?
Question, how would I have known it was a 9-bit virtual address had we not had this information? And that was from knowing it's 2 levels. And I just need to say, how many bits do we need for each level? And I determine that by saying, oh, our page tables are 8 bytes. How many entries does that hold? Well, each entry was 1 byte, so it holds 8. So I'm going to need to take out 3 bits each time I do a lookup. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that's basically what we were covering last time. So we were talking about multi-level page tables, this sort of general procedure. We have this series of array lockups. We have this key idea that at everything but the last level, we don't actually find out where data is, we find out where the next page table is. And we get that as a page number, so we have to like convert it back to a base address, because it's not the same format as our base register was. And some brief logistical notes. So, I guess 2 things. So, page table 2 is due not next Wednesday, but a week from next Wednesday. It's due 2 weeks from next Wednesday. Page table 1 is due next week. Then there's a week with no homework due dates. Then page table 2 is due on a Wednesday. It's due before the code review lab. And no late submissions except by special arrangement. The normal late policy does not apply because we're going to have you do a code review. The purpose of the submission is to know what you sent to that code review. So we'll talk about that code review later, but you know, therefore we won't allow late submissions for that except by special arrangement because it needs to be and match what you did in lab. Yes? The question is, do the Wednesday you get back from fall break? It's due the week after. And page table 3 is due the Friday after that. The intention is not that you do everything that's required for page table 3 and not for page table 2 in those 2 days. The intention is you do them earlier, you just won't check them before then. So also, another logistical note, Sync Lab is next week. Next week has no submission option. You have to go to lab or talk to us if you can't make it. So if you can't go to lab, you can't or shouldn't go to lab. To lab, talk to an instructor, or contact an instructor to make other arrangements. So questions on these logistical notes? Okay. So let's go on to our next topic, which is going to be about caches. And I believe we showed this at the beginning of the semester. So here's a microscope photograph of a 2004 single core chip. And one thing that was remarkable is sort of how much space is used for storage here. We have some space used for the registers that are kind of mixed in with our floating point and integer ALUs. We have these spaces used for caches of memory, and we have actually multiple types of them. So we have something labeled as a data cache that stores memory you like access through like move instructions or sort of operands that access memory in an instruction. And we have this instruction cache, which holds machine code that your program is processing. And these are like small, fast copies of hopefully your recently used data. And we're gonna talk about how do we make sure your recently used code and data ends up in these small, fast memories. And part of that picture is going to be that, well, we're going to have a backup for when it doesn't fit or isn't in the small fast memory, but we still want it to be faster than going to main memory. And in this processor, they have a level 2 cache that they decided was worth spending half the space on the chip for. They decided that don't want to add additional ALUs. Nope, we're going to put just more storage. Not going to put another core on there, just more storage. And this is a pretty common decision if you look at modern chips, that they'll devote a huge amount of space rather than to like more things that do computation to this cache storage. And we're going to have this general property that when we have these different storage elements, the smaller they are, the faster they are. So typically our registers, they're physically smaller and also hold less bits, but we can read out of them really fast. So we can read them every clock cycle typically, and we can read usually multiple values every clock cycle, like, you know 8-ish 64-bit values pretty commonly per clock cycle. Our bigger memories here are not gonna be as fast. They're going to take longer to access, and we're going to be able to get a bit less bandwidth out of them. And that's going to get worse as things get bigger. And on a more recent processor, in addition to having sort of a second level of cache, we usually have a third one. Most common way this works is this will be sort of one core, and we'll have like multiple copies of this single core sliding alongside a big L3 cache, is kind of the most common architecture. And, you know, when things aren't in the L3 cache, eventually we have to go to main memory. And kind of our main benefit of having these smaller storages is going to be that the latency, that is the time from when I figure out what I want to access to when I get that value back, is going to be dramatically faster sort of the smaller storage we're using. And typical numbers would be that registers, you know, it's like one clock cycle from when we figure out what register we want to read until we want to get the value. For main memory, that might be 50 to 100 nanoseconds, so like 100 times slower. So questions on this? Question, if I have a multiple core CPU, do they share any of the caches? Generally, usually yes. This depends on the CPU design. Most commonly, what current CPUs seem to have settled on is not sharing the L1 and L2 caches, but sharing the L3 caches between multiple cores. That's not the only choice you can make.
Does the OS handle then possible overwriting for accessing when it's used inside?
So the question is, if we have multiple caches that can store potentially the same thing, how do we keep those in sync? And this is a topic we will be ignoring in this class for the most part, but it is a major topic if you take a more advanced architecture course. And pretty much all modern processors that you're likely to use have settled on making this the job of the hardware. So the hardware is going to have to do some bookkeeping to figure out who has copies of a value and to synchronize updates to that value. The general term for this is cache coherency. We'll talk about some side effects of this a little bit when we talk about multi-threaded programming, but we're not going to talk about the details of how that works in this class, just for time reasons. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so I guess I should mention that you can't imagine a scheme where the OS would be responsible. This is just something we've not decided is not a good idea for most systems. And that gets me to sort of how cache works. So the caches we're going to talk about are transparent, that they're going to take the place of main memory. And the way that the processor is going to treat them is it's like you're talking to main memory, it just ends up being magically faster. And how this is going to work is that the processor, instead of making a request to main memory, it's going to make all its requests to access memory to the caches. And the cache is going to return back the response. And sometimes, the way the cache is going to do that is I'm going to ask to read something, the cache won't have any idea about that value, and it will just communicate with memory on the processor's behalf, get the response, and forward it back. Sometimes, we're going to be lucky. Actually, most of the time, we're hopefully going to be lucky. And the CPU will ask for something, and the cache will have had that value stored somehow. So somewhere in the cache, we've written down, what OX1234 is in advance, and that means when the CPU asks for OX1234, the cache just says, yep, here it is, without talking to the main memory. And that's going to be way faster because, well, we won't use the slow main memory. And in this picture, I label this as RAM, so that means main memory or another cache, because when we have these sort of hierarchies of caches, the level one cache will talk to the level two, the level two will talk to the level three, the level three will talk to main memory typically. Everyone will just go the next thing up the chain. So our cache, we can try to treat exactly like a memory, it's just faster most of the time. And kind of our goal in having this design is that we can pretend that we have just a really fast, really big memory. That's what we want the cache to act like. That's going to be as fast as these small memories that have really low latencies. But it's going to be able to store all the data I could want. It has the capacity of my main memory. To make this work, we're going to have this case where the CPU asks for a value and we have it be the case almost all the time. So we mentioned we have like 100x speed difference. So that means that 99% of the time to like get even close to hiding that speed difference, we need the value to be in the cache. And this is something that for typical programs, we will actually achieve. we will actually have a rate of, you know, greater than 99% for value is found in the cache. And because of that, we will actually usually maintain the solution. You may say, how the heck is that possible? And part of the reason that that's possible is that we're not going to always do this. We're not going to build something where every time the CPU asks for something, it's in memory, or even that we have any guarantees. In fact, we are not going to have guarantees. You can write programs which are going to have horrible rates of things being found in the cache. But the reason that caches are going to work is that we're going to have some properties that will just observe that you just accidentally have in your programs. When you write a program, your program sort of meets these two assumptions we're going to talk about of temporal locality and spatial locality, even though you weren't trying. So let's talk about these two assumptions that our caches are going to be built on. So one of them, I said, is temporal locality. And that's phrased as, if I see you accessing a value now, that means you're going to access it again soon. And this is helpful for caches because if we assume this is true, this tells us if I see the processor ask for something, I should store it in my fast memory for later, and that will be beneficial. We have the second property of spatial locality, which says that if I see a value being accessed, then nearby values will be accessed soon, where nearby means close memory addresses. And this means that if a processor asks for a value, I should, as a cache, preemptively get the values around it and store them for later. So, question, yes? So question, when it says adjacent, like how adjacent can we be? I am deliberately vague. We will make some specific design decisions in our caches that sort of limit how close we can take advantage of, but I'm deliberately vague because, you know, we can imagine taking advantage of sort of all different degrees of closeness. Yeah?
Does it?
Question, is it closeness in virtual memory or physical memory? So our caches will generally be dealing with physical addresses. So we won't really have the opportunity to take advantage of things that are close in virtual addresses but not physical addresses unless the virtual to physical mapping is laid out. So things that are close in virtual are also close in physical. This usually doesn't make that much of a difference because if you think of things being close, like let's say I have address 1234, what are things that are close to that? Well, like 1200, 1230, 1238, right? These are all things that are close to that, and most of the ones I came up with are going to be on the same page. So for the most part, the virtual to physical doesn't matter, but yeah, sometimes it does. And, well, the cache is going to have trouble taking advantage of things that are not close physically but close virtually. Unless the operating system lays out the memory, so, you know, that's actually... If we want to avoid that, we should have the operating system lay out the memory so things that are close virtually are also close physically. But usually it doesn't matter because when I'm talking about spatial locality, almost all the time we mean within a page. Other questions? Okay, and I assert on this slide that these are kind of things that happen naturally in our program. And to illustrate why, let's look at this function here, which is, you know, I don't think is contrived. This is kind of a very natural way of writing the task, in this case, of computing the mean of an array. And this function has excellent temporal and spatial locality. And it's not because I tried to write this function in a way that runs faster. I just wrote the function in kind of the most natural way to write the function. So I have excellent temporal locality because the assembly instructions for this for loop are going to get fetched over and over and over again. If I see them being fetched once, you know, like whatever the add instruction is there, It's a good guess that it's going to be fetched again soon. Like, not always, but almost all the time, assuming length is pretty big, that's going to be true. That's going to be a good heuristic, a good thing for our cache to take advantage of. I also have good spatial locality. If I think about the assembly for this loop, all the instructions are right next to each other in memory. They're at adjacent addresses. If the, you know, I less than is at address 1200, right, probably this, the add total plus equals is like at address 1210 or something, right? They're very close to each other just because that's how assembly works, right? We don't randomly jump way ahead. They're going to be actually, the machine code's going to actually be right next to each other for them, and our cache can take advantage of that. And I also have locality for my data accesses. So if I store total I or length in memory, which actually probably I hopefully don't, but if I do, that those values will be accessed over and over and over again and will have excellent temporal locality. Now, in practice, hopefully it doesn't matter for the cache because they'll be stored in registers, but if they're stored in memory, excellent temporal locality. And when I'm accessing this array, you might say, well, there's no temporal locality there because I access values of 0 and never access it again. So there's no temporal locality in values, but there's great spatial locality. If I see values of 0 being accessed, that means the things nearby in the values array are going to be accessed soon. In particular, values 1, 2, 3, really great idea to load those faster, and that's something our cache can take advantage of. So this sort of code that, you know, I didn't specialize just naturally has great temporal and spatial locality. If my caches implement strategies that take advantage of that, I will get a great performance. You know, most of the time the value will be in the cache. And I assert that pretty much all the code you write is going to have things like this going on, even if you're not trying. Now, can you write your code to have more of it? Absolutely. But you don't need to try, and that's why caches are so powerful on normal machines. Yeah?
So, in this example, say I declared length like a long time ago, but then all of a sudden started using it a lot in this for loop, would it like, would the machine like recognize that I've started using it again and like upgrade it in terms of locality, or?
So the question is, let's say length was initially used way long ago, and then we start running this loop. Would we be able to take advantage of that temporal locality still? Absolutely, because the rule is, I see it being accessed, I guess I should have it hashed because it's going to be accessed soon. And that rule will still be true, even though a while ago, you know, it was accessed and then left idle. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, how does it break up the instructional data? So we don't need to, right? So these locality assumptions, we don't need to be exact. If we happen to, for example, for spatial locality, right? Let's say I store in the cache, you know, this for loop and also the code of, you know, some function after this. Well, then I wasted a little space storing the code of the function after it, which I'll never use, but that's probably fine because I'm still getting so much good performance from the stuff I correctly cached. So when we take advantage of these heuristics, you know, sometimes they're going to make us cache things that, you know, I guess that, you know, aren't useful, but that's fine because often enough they'll make us cache things that are useful, that it'll still be a net win by a huge margin. Does that answer your question? And another example I could give for that is like, the strategies we have will like make us cache things after the end of the values array. That's probably still fine because we've gained so much by caching the parts of the values array that were actually used that we're not going to care if we have a little waste. Okay. Other questions? Okay, and I had a question about how things were split into how caches were shared across cores. So I have here kind of the typical hierarchy we're going to have. is that usually we have a separate cache for instructions and data on each core. And the most common design these days is we have a common L2 cache for each core and then a shared L3 cache. You can see processors that do some different variations of this. You know, it's a matter of what did the processor maker think was fastest given the type of memories they were using and what programs they wanted to run. And typically we have, you know, separate data instruction caches, and one reason for that is that usually the instruction data is completely different than the data cache data, so it doesn't make sense to combine them. It's not going to help us. We aren't going to get any efficiency gains. And it's harder to build a bigger cache that takes two outputs at once than two smaller caches that give us one output at a time. Also, we can use different sort of cache designs for the instruction versus data cache. So that's another reason to choose that design. Because, for example, data caches need to handle writes, instruction caches don't. And we can take advantage of that. Okay. So we know kind of a high level of caches, and we know we're going to want to take advantage of this locality property. So let's look at a simple cache design and kind of expand that, and then we'll think about how is locality being taken advantage of. But first, I'll start with the simplest cache design I can think of. I'm going to have a cache that stores 2 bytes. There's my 2 bytes. And I'm going to have it store something from memory. And to think about what from memory we're going to store, I'm going to divide up memory into 2-byte chunks, just arbitrarily, starting with address 0, that's 1 2-byte chunk, address 2, 1 2-byte chunk, address 4, and so on. And for my cache, I'm going to put exactly one of those chunks in the cache. This is my sort of simplest possible design. Okay, so that's my cache. Let's think about what my cache needs to do. If we remember the interface I told you our caches are going to have, we're going to have to get an address from the processor and figure out whether to forward that to memory or not. And we kind of have ourselves in a little bit of a corner here. If the processor says, hey, I want to reach address 01011, the only way I can figure out if this value is the value from 01011, has the value from 01011, is by checking what's in that value in memory. And that's obviously wouldn't help us, because the whole point of having this cache is we don't go to memory most of the time. So we're going to need to add some bookkeeping information. And there's kind of 2 cases about our value in cache. So one case is that this 0000 doesn't represent anything. I haven't even loaded anything for memory yet. So to represent that, like with our page tables, I'm going to have a valid bit to say, is this block of data even loaded yet? Or is it something that never came from memory? Okay, so we're going to fetch the value in that case. And I've divided that memory this way, so this is the value I want to give back to the processor. And an assumption I'm going to have because of temporal locality is that I should cache that value the processor just asked for. Because temporal locality, if it's true, tells us it's going to ask for it again soon. I probably should have it in my cache. So I'm going to store that value in my cache. But if you look here, I still don't have enough bookkeeping information to give that value back to the processor if it asks for it again soon, because I won't know, did it actually come from 01011 or did it come from 11011, for example. I don't know that from what I have stored. I have to go to memory and like figure out if it doesn't match correctly. That's not acceptable. So one option would be I could store where this value came from. So I got this block here from address 01010. So I could write down 01010. I could write down that address in my cache and then compare it when there's a request for another value to say, is it from the right block of 2 bytes? So I'm going to use a little space-saving trick. If you look at each of the blocks of memory I have, the last bit doesn't matter. right? They always range from something 0 to something 1. So I can record which value I have in here by chopping off that last bit, because we always know it's 0 to 1. And I will call what I get when I do that the tack. And that's what I'll store in my cache. So now, when the processor asks for the value 01011, I know that this is going to come from, this is going to be the second byte of the 01010 through 01011 block. And I need to find out, do I have that block? And if I do, well, the tag will have been these first 4 bits, 0101, and I'll compare to that. If the processor asked for a different byte, one, I know that this is, say, 100, and I want to figure out if I have it. Well, I expect the tag for 100 to be 1000, and that will match, and I'll say it's not there, and I'll need to go to memory to fetch it. So when the processor asks for that again, we're going to retrieve the value. And we're going to have a name for the other part of the address. So we have called these top bits are the tag. They tell us which of the possible blocks we have stored, right? We have a whole bunch of different blocks we're going to have stored. I need to know which one did I put there. The tag tells me that. This remaining bit tells me, do I have the first byte or the second byte of that 2-byte block? We're going to call the remaining bit, or if we have bigger than 2-byte block bits, the offset. Okay. Questions about our simple 1-block cache before we move on to something bigger and more flexible? Yeah. The question is, how do we get it into the cache? So what happened in this scenario is our processor asked for that value for memory, and we figured out it wasn't in our cache, so we loaded it. So we said, you're asking for that value, let me load the block that contains it into the cache, because that's going to be useful later.
So you did have to access physical memory?
So we did have to access memory the first time, and if the processor asked for it again, we don't. And that's going to be generally true of our caches, that, you know, we're not, that I guess, in the design we're going to discuss in lecture, we're generally only going to load things because the processor asks for it. Where we're going to get benefit is when we can reuse something we already loaded. It is true that sort of real processors do have cases where they load things when the processor doesn't request them, but that's kind of a, you know, secondary, more advanced thing to do. Isn't the primary way caches work. Okay, so let's expand this, because something you might not like about this is that we can store exactly one value, and we know most programs are accessing more than one value at a time, you know, like computing on like 2 arrays or something. So let's have a cache that stores more than one block of data. So I had 1 block of 2 bytes, let's have 4 blocks of 2 bytes. And there are multiple ways I can organize these 4 blocks of 2 bytes, even though I've decided 4 blocks to do this. There's multiple ways I can organize it. I'm going to choose a particular way of organizing it called a direct mapped cache. And this is going to be one of the simpler ideas as far as implementing it in hardware. So I've decided to have these 4 2-byte blocks, and I need to decide, okay, let's say I decide I want to cache this value, this block of 2233. Where do I put that? Which of these 4 slots do I put that in? And in the direct map design, I'm going to make a decision that each value in memory has exactly one place it's assigned to in the cache. So this decision has the disadvantage that I can't be as flexible as far as, you know, having the most options to store things, but it's going to have the advantage that when I went to look for a value, when the processor asked me, where is this address, I know exactly where to check. I don't need to check multiple places. There's one place to check. If it's there, I have it. If it's not there, I don't. And the mapping I'm going to choose is that I'm going to say the first block of memory goes to the first block of the cache. The second block goes to the second block, and so on until we run out. In that case, we'll go back to using the first block of cache, in this case for the fifth block of memory, and so on. And because I've chosen a power of 2 size for the number of blocks I have, we can figure out which block to go to by looking at these bits of the address, which we will call the index bits. And this means that figuring out where to find a value in our cache or where to store a value in our cache is going to be super fast. Remember, with the page tables, we liked it. That was really nice that we could take some bits of the virtual address and just use them as an array index. Same idea here. We can take some bits of the address, use it as an array index into our cache, really fast to look up. Don't need to search anything. Don't need to do any division or anything like that. It's just a little bit operation. So we're going to have this first index 0 value that could store the address 0 value, the address 1000 value, the address 10000 value, and so on. And our index 1 could store the address 2 value, the address 6 value, and so on. So we have one place for each block of memory to store it in the cache. And basically, we're going to take turns about which of those blocks we put in. And we're going to need some additional information to know, well, what's actually stored in these four blocks right now. And it's going to be the same information we saw with our one block cache. We're going to have a valid bit to say, did I even load anything in there yet? If I just booted up and haven't put anything in the cache yet, we have nothing there, we want to remember that. And I also need to know, well, I had a bunch of choices about where to put it. So let's say I'm accessing 01011. Well, I'm going to load this block here into the cache that contains the value we wanted, the BB, mark it as valid, but I also need to remember where it came from. I'm going to have a tag, and the tag is going to be the bits of the address I didn't use. So I could have written here that this is from, you know, instead of writing that tag, I could have written that this is from 01010 through 01011. And you notice the tag isn't that, right? It's tag is less. So how do we compress that from 01010 to 01011 information to 01? Why could we do that? So we can get rid of the last bit because we know every block, you know, every block covers all of these, covers both, you know, 0 to 1. So we don't need the last bit. And I know that if it's in the index 01 row, I know the next two bits have to be the index bits. They have to be 01 because it's in the second row. Everything from in the second row comes from an address with a 01 in that, those positions. So I don't need to write down those bits. So I end up only writing down the top two bits in this example, like all the bits we didn't use already. So we use the last bit to figure out which of the two bytes is it. Is it the AA1 or the BB? We use the next two bits to figure out which row we go to. And I only need to record the bits I haven't used yet to figure out where it came from. So now I can reconstruct the full address, you know, with the information that's there. I can just say, okay, this has 01. Well, it must have come from tag 01, index 0, 1. And offset 0, 2, 1, right? That's where I can reconstruct the whole address of that range from just that tag and what row it's in and how big the blocks are. Okay, so questions about this direct mapped cache? Yeah.
For the values surrounding this, would you do the ones that are just closest to this, the spatial locality, and the ones you store in the cache?
So your question is, given that I just talked about spatial locality, wouldn't it be a great idea to like load CCDD2 or load 8899? And it might be, we're not going to do that. So you might say, are we taking advantage of spatial locality? And I would argue, yes. How are we taking advantage of spatial locality? Well, I loaded 2 bytes, even though the processor asked for 1. So if the processor asks for the AA byte soon, which is right next to it, then I'll have an extra hit. So I am taking advantage of spatial locality, but as you observe, not as much as we perhaps could be. But what we'll do with this design of cache is if we want to take more advantage of spatial locality, probably the first thing we'll think about doing is, can I make the blocks bigger? So if I have the blocks be 4 bytes instead of 2, right, that would take more advantage of that without us doing, you know, separate load operations. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so some terminology. We're going to call the rows of this direct map cache a set, which means that sometimes when I talk about index bits, I'll call them set index bits. You might say, why are we calling it a set? There's just one thing. Well, preview, we're going to expand our direct map cache design to be a more flexible type of cache, which has multiple things in a set. And we talked about splitting up the address into this offset, index, and tag, and how big those are is going to depend on what cache design we chose. So I kind of showed you 4 sets and some number of address bits and some number of bytes per block. We can vary all these parameters. So in this example, I have 6-bit addresses, and the address 001111 stores FF, and I have that stored in these 3 different cache designs. So let's look at what's going on in these 3 caches. So in this first cache here, I have 2-byte blocks and 4 sets. So I have set indexes 00 through 11. You know, that's how I represent 4 values, 0 to 3. And I have 2-byte blocks, so they have offset 0 or 1. So I can look at this FF here, and I can reconstruct that value and say, okay, that's offset 1. It's in not this 0 column, it's in the 1 column. It's index 11, and its tag is 001. And we can see that's just a way of splitting up the original address we started with. For this 4-byte block, 2-set cache, I have my offsets 0 through 3. And our FF value is an offset 3, which in binary I'd write as 11. So we can also write this probably here 00011011. And I have index 1, I'm in row 1, and there's 1 bit because there's 2 possible values. And I have tag 001 again. And that's another way of splitting up the same address. And it's not a coincidence, like that's how we figured out where it was in the cache. Oh, I wrote this in the wrong column because I'm being consistent. And that's just another way of splitting up this address. We have, that's the offset, that's the index, and 001 is our tag in this case. In our 8-set cache, we have offset 0 or 1. In this case, it's 1. I have index 111. And then I have tag 00. That's again just another way of splitting up the address. So we have this general idea that when we do a lookup in one of these direct map caches, we're going to split up our address into an offset part that tells us where in the block to go, an index part that tells us which row to go to, and a tag, which is everything left over. And how many bits we use for the offset and the index are going to vary based on how many bits we have, how many bytes we have on the block, and how many rows we have. And I have this also written down here. So questions about how I split up this address for each of these three caches? Yeah.
Generally, more sets means the indexes have more bits, and more bytes per block means the indexes are fewer bits.
This question, more sets means the indexes have more bits? Yes. More bytes per block means the indexes have fewer bits if we have fewer rows. So what determines, so the number of sort of the number of index bits is going to be sort of log base 2 of the number of indices, right? And the number of offset bits is log base 2 of the number of offsets that are possible, aka the size of a block. Yeah.
Is it just arbitrary to make the leading bits the tag and the middle bits the index?
So the question is, why are the most significant bits the tag instead of something else? Yeah. Something like. So we could indeed make caches where other bits are the index. The big reason we don't, it has to do with spatial locality. So by choosing this design, if we have, like, if I go back to our original example here, right, I would really like to be able to store this set of continuous values in the cache at the same time. If I chose to make the upper bits the index, I wouldn't be able to do that as easily. But by making the least significant bits I have left after the offset the index, I can always make that work. So for this reason, like, it's having the index bits be just after the offset bits is the best choice and what we'll always do. Other questions? Okay, so we have this splitting into tag, index, and offset, and there's some other terms we're gonna have to deal with, and one that we'll commonly talk about is the size of a cache. And by convention, when we talk about a cache size, we mean the amount of data in the cache and not its metadata. So for example, we will say that this cache here, which stores four 2-byte blocks, is an, four 2-blocks, yes, is an, is a 8-byte cache. Even though, if you're counting, you might say, well, it stores, this is 8 bytes, this is another byte, and this is another byte. You might say, doesn't it use 10 bytes of storage? It absolutely does. Or sorry, 10 bytes of storage. It absolutely uses 10 bytes of storage. But we'll call it an 8-byte cache. When we talk about cache size, we only mean the data. We don't mean the bookkeeping information, even though, yeah, it takes up space. And this is true universally. So if someone tells you your processor has a 4-megabyte cache, they mean it has 4 megabytes of data. It also has some probably relatively significant additional storage for all the bookkeeping information. And if you don't want to kind of reason about these pictures, we have some formulas that you can derive from that picture for how big our address is and our caches. So I mentioned that the number of set index bits is equal to log base 2, the number of indices, or which is the number of sets. And this is kind of what, this is exactly what that's telling us. And you could kind of derive that from the picture I showed you earlier. And my recommendation is to know how those pictures work, not memorize these formulas, because I find that, at least I find that way more reliable. I do not find memorizing these formulas helpful. I always just think of what's the picture look like and derive it from that. And our block size, we had this idea that the number of offset bits is log base 2, the number of possible offsets, also known as the sort of the block size. And that's exactly what this formula is telling us. We're just solving for a little lowercase b. And our tag, right, is everything that was left over after we accounted for the index and offset. That's all this is saying. And I mentioned cache size is the amount of data. So that's the number of rows times the bytes per row. So any questions on how we can derive all these formulas by just knowing how that picture works? Okay, so let's do a little exercise. So let's say I have a cache with 64 byte blocks and 128 sets. So based on that, it stores 8,192 bytes of data. And let's say I'm using 32-bit addresses to access the cache. How many tag, index, and offset bits are there? And once you figure it out, second question is, which things are in the same block as the byte I got from address 1037, right? That when I fetch that block, right, that doesn't just have 1037's byte, it also has some stuff around it, like probably 1038 and 1036. Which of these other ones are also included? So give you some time to work on that, check with your neighbor, you agree on what should happen. Okay, in the interest of time, I will start going over my solution here. So we have, helpful to know that 64 is 2 to the 6, 128 is 2 to the 7. So this is a 2 to the 6 byte blocks, which means we have 6 offset bits. We need 6 bits to tell 0 to 63 index in a block. I have 2 to the 7 sets, which means I need 7 index bits to tell which of this 128 rows, 0 to 127, to go to. And everything else, so 32 minus 13, is the number of tag bits. Some questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so then which things are stored in the same block? And a key thing to remember is that our blocks sort of start at 0 and are always at multiples of the block size. So the block has to start at a multiple of 64. So one way you could have figured it out is you could have taken 1037 in hex, divided it by 64, rounded down, multiplied, and that would be the first byte of the block. In which case you discover that the block was 0x100 through 0x103f. Another way we could figure that out is that if I take the bits of 1037, well, I can divide it up into this offset and then an index and a tag. So the index is 7 bits and then the tag. And I know that everything that's in the same block only varies in the offset. The tag and index have to be the same because that's how we get to the right row. Right, and the tag has to be the same because we get everything and put the same tag on it. It also comes from the same block. So another way I can say this is that the valid values for this are 00100000, all 0 offset through all 1 offset. That's the range of our block, and that's going to be the same 0x100 through 0x103f. Those are two ways of deriving it. So like, for the second, basically the idea I had is the block always ranges from offset 0 to max offset. I just said, what's that? That's 1000 offset 0 to 103f. And so I just take the things that are in that, and that's my answer for this. So next time, we'll look over kind of simulating how the cache works. And then talking about sort of going beyond the direct map design.